Apophis, possibilities, 2036, of an impact, possibility. And how about Mars, our neighbor? It could get hit in about a month. We'll be back with Philip late in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Philip, let's talk about the most pressing issue. That is the possibility of an asteroid impact with Mars on January 30th.
Yeah, this caught me by surprise. We know that other objects in the solar system get bombarded just like the Earth does. You can look at the moon and see craters, and it's very clear that these are from asteroid impacts. And in fact, Mars has craters on it, and up close, the rovers have actually spotted meteorites and craters on the surface of Mars. But we've never actually seen this happen, except for when a comet hit Jupiter in 1994. And so it was quite a bit of a surprise when it was found that it's possible that an asteroid, a very small asteroid called 2007 WD5, might hit Mars on January 30th. Now, this is a pretty small object. It's in the range of the size of a house or something like that. So it's not terribly big. When it hits, it would be like a hydrogen bomb blowing up on the surface of Mars. So that would be bad if you were standing there, but from a few miles away, you'd be plenty safe.
Yeah.
And the really amazing thing, the thing that made my jaw drop, was when they said the odds of it hitting Mars are better than 1%. It's like 1 in 75. Now, the reason they can't know for sure whether it's going to hit or not is because it's orbiting the sun, and you don't know exactly its position because it's very small. You have to take pictures of it. And when you measure it off of the pictures you're taking, you can't get an exact position.
I see.
And so there's a little bit of slop in where it is. And so what you have to do is keep observing it, find images taken of it, maybe by accident from a year ago or something like that, and that could really nail down the orbit. And so up until today, the odd was 1 in 75. Now, what's funny is that literally an hour before the show, I was reading the Planetary Society's blog. The Planetary Society is this great group of people who advocate planetary science. And my friend Emily Lakdawalla is their blogger, and she has some news that new observations from two different people have changed possibly the odds of it hitting. And it goes in different directions. This kind of stuff makes me crazy. One set of observations makes it less likely that it's going to hit Mars, that it's only a 1 in 300 chance.
Okay.
But the other observations from a different group say, no, we've actually revised it to 1 in 25.
Whoa.
So that basically what that's telling you is that depending on when you observe it and what you observe it with and how you do your calculations, it's very difficult to nail these things down. As we get closer to the date, we'll know better. There is absolutely no danger to us here on Earth. This thing is not going to splash up rocks, which will rain down on Earth, nothing like that. But if, you know, there are probably 1,000 astronomers, probably 10,000 astronomers, desperately wishing this will happen. Because, first of all, really cool. We like big explosions too, and to actually see this would be really excellent. But it also will tell us things like how objects moving really rapidly move through Mars's atmosphere. What happens when you impact a relatively large object into a solid surface? We can model this kind of stuff here. There's an astronomer named Dan Derda. You've had him on the show before.
Yes.
He's an old friend of mine. He does this. He actually takes pellets and accelerates them to several miles per second using a gun that NASA has developed. And you can impact these into other rocks and see what happens. But even that is slow compared to how fast these asteroids impact. And the physics is difficult to model. So if something like this were to happen on Mars, where we've got orbiters that can observe it and rovers that can look at the damage, this is a fantastic laboratory for us where we don't have to worry about one hitting us and being dangerous. So this would be a wonderful, wonderful thing if it does happen. There's no danger, and we get to learn a lot, and it would be totally cool.
And as long as it's not devastating.
Well, yeah, it would be small. An object roughly this size hit Siberia in 1908. In Tunguska, right near the Tunguska River. And flattened trees for hundreds of square miles, if you prefer. And the damage was pretty serious. If this had happened over a major city, we could have lost a lot of folks. It's been a mystery for a long time what this thing was, because there was no crater. And then it was realized that these things blow up in the atmosphere, and it creates a huge fireball. And that's what caused the trees to flatten. It was this enormous blast wave. Interestingly, just a couple of weeks ago, the folks at Sandia Labs out in New Mexico, where they do a lot of research into explosions, basically nuclear weapons, they came up with a new type of computer program to model how this happened. And they discovered that the Tunguska impactor, this asteroid, this chunk of rock that came in, was actually a little bit smaller than was previously thought. They thought it might have been as much as 100 yards across. Now they're thinking it might have been 70 yards across. And what happened was this blast from the explosion was actually sort of focused into a jet or a finger of pressure that came down and slammed into the ground. And the reason this is important, you think, oh, 100 meters, 70 meters, who cares? The reason it's important is that there are more objects that are smaller out in space than bigger. There, if you were to count up all the 100-yard-wide asteroids in the solar system and then count up all the 70-yard-wide asteroids, there would be far more of the smaller ones, which means that a Tunguska-like impact happens on Earth more often than we thought, which makes it more important that we discover these things and figure out a way of pushing them aside before they hit.
Wow. Now let's talk about Apophis. 2036, they say the possibilities are there. It could hit us.
Yeah, this is, off the top of my head, I don't know how big it is, but I know it's big. Big enough that if it hits, it would be very, very bad. And it's one of these things where it really doesn't matter where it hits. It could have very serious ramifications on the entire planet. Now, this thing is on, I believe, a 7-year orbit. Again, this is off the top of my head, so I'm not quite sure. But I do know that in 2029, it will pass by the Earth. Now, imagine, the Earth is a giant mass. It's this planet with gravity. And if the asteroid passes very close to the Earth, the orbit of the asteroid will be changed a lot. And if it passes farther from the Earth, its orbit won't be changed very much. And it turns out that there is a region of space called the keyhole. And if the asteroid passes right through that, like an arrow going through the keyhole of a door, the orbit of the asteroid will be changed precisely enough that 7 years later, in 2036, it'll come back and smack into the Earth. If it passes too close, the orbit gets changed too much, and it won't hit. And if it passes farther out, then its orbit won't be changed enough to move it into this impacting orbit. And so astronomers are really studying this thing, as you might imagine, to see if it's going to pass through the keyhole. One of the ideas, actually, and I like this idea a lot, is on its next pass, which I'm not sure when that is, but it's sometime pretty soon, to land a radio transponder on it. And that would give off a signal which would allow astronomers to measure very precisely the location and the orbit of this object. And that way we would know well in advance if it's going to pass through the keyhole or not. And if it will, hey, let's get our act together. We got to do something about this.
Well, let's find out. We've got some. You know what's amazing, though, to me, Philip, and I've talked to Dan Dirt about this, is that some of these things we just won't even know about. Some of them miss the planet, and we know about it after it's gone past us.
That's right. It's funny. People say, how can you possibly miss it? Well, a lot of these things are small. They're 100 yards across, 200 yards across, which is small. That's like a hill, right, on Earth.
Sure.
And they're dark. They're made of very dark material, which means they're very dim. And you don't see them until they're very close. And because of the geometry of the solar system, where the sun is, where the Earth is, where these things tend to come from, we actually don't get it. They don't become really bright until they pass us by, and then we see them. And so it's a little bit terrifying to think that the next Tunguska impact, you know, we won't know about it until it happens, until you look up and see this blast of light in the sky. So that's why astronomers are taking this very seriously. We want big telescopes scanning the sky to look for it. And Dan is part of an organization called the B612 Foundation, and they have Rusty Schweikert, the Apollo 9 astronaut.
Yeah, he's a booster and trying to get these asteroids taken care of.
Yeah, I was able, Dan and I were at a meeting it was sort of a public, like a science fiction convention, except for space. And a lot of the Apollo astronauts were there, and I got a chance to sit Dan introduced me to Rusty, and we talked for a long time about Apophis specifically and some other asteroids and keyholes, and it was just fascinating. And this group is saying, look, we got to do something about it. And it's not like Armageddon or Deep Impact where you just want to lob nuclear weapons at these things. That might be a good way of pushing them out of the way, but you can't control it. And for all you know, there's another keyhole out there that this thing's going to pass through and then hit the Earth 5 years later. You don't want to do that. So what you do is maybe you lob a nuclear weapon at it, push it out of the nearest keyhole if you know it's going to impact. And that just is sort of, you just sort of slam it and get it out of the way. Then what you do is you take a spacecraft and you put it near the asteroid with a rocket on it that will actually tug the asteroid using the gravity of the spaceship. You don't actually connect it to the asteroid with tethers, or you don't
just stay relatively close to it, huh?
That's exactly right. And the mass of the rocket over several months or years will move the asteroid out of the way using the gravity of the rocket. It's a fantastic idea. And in practice, it's tough to do, but it's not impossible. The technology is there. We just have to start working on it.
Asteroids.
These guys are fighting NASA, trying to get NASA to fund this stuff.
Yeah, they're not too happy with the way it's being funded now, I don't think.
No, there are NASA studies, and there are other studies, and they sort of disagree on how to do this. And I've read the NASA studies, and I got to say, it doesn't seem like NASA's taking this seriously, but I suspect they're going down the wrong path. And I think B612 is on the right idea. We need to actually do these radio transponders. We need to study this stuff. And in fact, with the new spacecraft that NASA's building to go back to the moon, it would be in some ways easier to land on an asteroid that's going to pass near the Earth. An asteroid like Eros, which is a pretty big one, potato-shaped dude, which orbits and gets near the Earth, we could land on that. In some ways, it'd be easier than landing on the moon because you don't have to accelerate as much. They don't pass the Earth very rapidly. So it's kind of easy to hop onto one of these things.
Yeah.
We could land men and women on these things and actually study them up close and figure out how to take care of them if one of them's got our number on it.
Well, I can send Bruce Willis up there and his team, huh?
Yeah, as long as we leave him there.
Yeah. That was a great movie.
I like Bruce Willis.
It's a great movie. It really is. Hey, you know, here we were coming out of the Christmas week now into New Year's. What's your take on the Star of Bethlehem? I've heard so many different thoughts on that.
And actually, the fact that you hear so many different explanations of it, I think, is a clue into what we're looking at. This is a wonderful little story. It's in Matthew, second chapter, I think it is, right at the beginning. And it says that the three wise men saw a star to the east. And when you read the Greek, which I cannot do because I don't read Greek, but it uses the word aster, which literally means star. But, 2,000 years ago, could have meant any sort of astronomical phenomenon. And so people have been searching high and low looking for something that would be the star, quote-unquote. And they've looked at comets. They've looked at exploding stars that get bright. They've looked at what are called planetary conjunctions, when a planet or two get close to each other. And actually, this can be a very striking event. When Jupiter and Venus, which are two of the brightest planets, get close to each other, it's really quite amazing when you see it. It's beautiful. And I noticed that you had a link to an astronomer who said that it might have been a supernova just the other day. You had a link to that. And that supernova, he said he found something called Kestaven 75. I'm not hugely convinced by this because you can actually, by looking at the remnants of the star that exploded, you can actually get a fairly decent estimate of the age. And the upper limits on that one are about 1,700 years, which makes it a little bit too young to be the Star of Bethlehem. But when I look at all these explanations, what strikes me is that, after all of this searching, we still don't know. And if it were bright enough of an object to cause this much of a stir, it seems to me that it would be some sort of obvious event. And so what I think, my own personal opinion on this, is that what seems most likely to me is that there may have been some relatively minor event conjunction of planets or something like that. And over the years, it has been like a fish story, right?
Yeah,
it gets
it got bigger and bigger.
And now we have the three wise men following this star. And now I'm thinking, you know, it's a nice story. I think it's been exaggerated a little bit. There may be some kernel of truth to it. But I think searching for this event is not going to get you very far, because we, you know, after all the searching, we still haven't found anything. And if you're of the mind that this was some sort of miracle, then why look for a scientific basis of it? A miracle, by definition, is something that science cannot explain. And so, if you're looking for a miracle, then looking for the scientific aspects of it sort of undercuts your belief in the first place. So I don't put a whole lot of stock in it right now.
Could it have been some kind of comet?
You know, that's certainly possible. There are bright comets every few years. We just had a couple of spectacular comets. Comet Holmes just a couple of months ago.
It started disintegrating a little bit, didn't it?
Yeah, for reasons that I still haven't heard why this might have happened, although this comet has been known to do this before. And comets in general have done this before. They're basically giant balls of ice. And when I say ice, I tend to say frozen gases. And people say it can't be a gas if it's frozen. And I tell them, well, that's to distinguish it from ice, which you think of as being frozen water. But on a comet, you can have frozen ammonia, frozen methane, frozen nitrogen. And when it gets near the sun, this stuff becomes a gas, and it surrounds the solid part, and you get this giant fuzzy object that we call a comet. But that tends to happen when it's near the sun. Comet Holmes was already out past, I think, Mars's orbit when it suddenly had this huge outburst and became really bright. I mean, I saw it jumped.
Yeah, the magnitude just exploded, literally.
It got a million times brighter. And a few days later, as this cloud of debris expanded, you could actually look up. I saw this from my front yard right here. You could look up and say, that's not a star. It's fuzzy. And that was amazing. And earlier in the year, before I moved out to California, to Boulder, where I live now, I was in California, Comet McNaught, which I think was in January, was bright enough to be seen during the day. I actually put the sun behind the roof of my house to block it out, and I could see this comet clearly with my naked eye. It was unbelievable how bright this thing was. And so you get these fantastically bright comets, but the problem is there just were no bright comets at that time that we know of. And the Chinese didn't note anything, although the Chinese records are kind of spotty. But the Koreans were good astronomers back then. There were other civilizations that were observing the skies, and they didn't say anything about any of this stuff. And that's another indication that I think, well, you know, maybe, again, this was just maybe some sort of relatively rare but not spectacular event that kind of got conflated over the years or inflated over the years.
You were just talking about the Chinese. Did you catch the... the conspiracy story about that their images might have been fake, their moon probe?
Yeah, this was beautiful. They have a probe they sent to the moon recently. It's called Chang. Oh, see, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's spelled Chang-E-1. So it's probably Chang-E-1, but I haven't heard it actually said out loud. And it's orbiting the moon right now, and it's taking some really cool pictures, some images. And they were very proud. They released this beautiful mosaic of the lunar surface. And this is it has a relatively limited field of view. It can't see the whole moon at once. So it takes a series of images, and then they figure out how to stitch them together to make a giant mosaic. And they displayed this. And some people started noticing that the some of the craters looked funny, and things didn't look right. And then there were these claims that they'd taken an earlier NASA image from Clementine, I think it was, which was not a NASA image. It was actually some images that were taken by the military some years ago with a different probe, and they had just basically photoshopped them. Clearly that wasn't right because the shadows were pointing in the wrong direction, all this. But there was still this issue of the craters looking funny, and it turns out all it was they didn't stitch the images together correctly. Again, Emily Lakdawala, this blogger for the Planetary Society, stumbled on this. She figured this out. And once you actually put the images together correctly, everything was fine. Conspiracy
all right,
stay theory with closed.
Us, you got it. Much more to talk about the next hour, your phone calls. Hey, next hour, let's open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Philip Plait. It'll be our final hour with Philip, but I'll be right back. We've still got some more things to talk with him about on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Philip, Galaxy Zoo. It's a website. Talk a little bit more about it.
Oh, yeah. This is a really cool idea. Telescopes are getting to the point now where we can observe so much and get so much data that it's really hard to process it all. This has been happening for a few years. It's happening with the Mars orbiters, that the images are coming in so quickly that you just can't sit there and process the data and analyze it quickly enough. And so they've started to farm it out to just people on the web. And this is a great idea. You know, your random person isn't going to be, I hate to use the word qualified because that sounds a little elitist, but in fact, you know, you can't just look at a picture and be able to say, oh, yes, I see this type of feature and that kind of feature. It takes a certain amount of training, years of school and all that, to be able to get into the detail. But there are some really good things that people can do relatively easily. For example, when you take a deep picture of the sky, you see lots of stars, but you also see lots of galaxies. And computers, there are programs out there to try to classify galaxies, whether they're elliptical or irregular or spiral, the three main classes. And elliptical is pretty much what you expect. It looks like a fuzzball shaped like a football or something like that. Irregular ones are distorted and weird. And spirals look like pinwheels, the kind of galaxy you kind of think of when you think of a galaxy. It's hard to train a computer to understand the different shapes. But people look at them and bang, done, easy, right? So the Galaxy Zoo folks, what they did is they took the data from this telescope. Whenever they find a galaxy, they put it in their database, and then you can sign up to be a member. You basically just train for a few minutes. They give you some exercises to do. It's really easy. And then you can identify galaxies. You can click on them. And it sounds boring at first, but when you start to do it, you realize that some of these things are just beautiful, and you're seeing galaxies that maybe nobody's ever seen before. And immediately I was hooked. I blogged about it, and a lot of other people did. They got a huge number of volunteers, and they got a forum set up where people were sharing galaxy images. Oh, look at this one. This one's cool. This one's cool. Well, what they started to do is they when you look at a spiral galaxy, the arms start at the center, and they curve outward. And you can imagine an arm starting at the top of the center of the galaxy, and it might curve to the right. And that's what you might call a counterclockwise spiral, because it would be spinning counterclockwise. If the arm went to the left, it would be spinning clockwise. Well, they decided to actually make that one of the things you can identify. If you're observing a spiral, is it a counterclockwise or a clockwise spiral? And you would expect that in space, you would see even numbers of these things. They're oriented randomly. And so, you know, if you're looking at, you can imagine if you're looking at a CD spinning and you're looking down on it from above and it's spinning clockwise, if you go under it and look up at it, it looks like it's spinning counterclockwise. And so any galaxy looks like it could be spinning clockwise or counterclockwise depending on which view you have of it. So if you view enough of these things, they should be split 50-50. And they're not. What they're finding is that there are more counterclockwise spirals identified than clockwise, and they don't know why. Now, I thought about this when they released this, and I thought, oh, no, come on, right? But it looks like that is what's happening. The question is, this is a real thing? Are there more counterclockwise galaxies out there? Or is it something that when people see them, it makes them easier to identify? And, you know, one way or another, this is telling us something important. We just don't know what it is. And this is totally cool. This is a completely unexpected result. And this is either going to tell us something about the universe or something about psychology. And either way, you know, I'm dying to find out what it is.
Are you a believer in the multiverse theory?
Ooh, wow. This is the idea that the universe is not the only universe, that there are other universes out there. And maybe they're in different dimensions, or maybe our universe may have been spawned from a bigger universe. There are all sorts of weird quantum mechanics things that sort of allow baby universes to bud off of bigger universes. This is a really interesting idea. It is not disallowed by quantum mechanics. In other words, it could happen. The question is, does it happen? And the problem is, how do you observe something that is totally dissociated from your own universe? And it turns out, I think I've talked about this before on the show, it was a long time ago, that it is possible that when you observe the glow of the Big Bang, that there's basically this microwave glow all around the sky. It's sort of like the afterglow of the initial event. And you've probably seen pictures of this. COBE was a satellite that first observed it, and WMAP is another NASA satellite that has mapped this. And by looking at it and very carefully mapping this, you can determine things about the universe, how old it is, possibly when the first stars were born, how much dark matter is in it. This stuff all kind of falls out of observing this stuff. It turns out that by looking at a different aspect of this glow, this sounds like science fiction to me, but you can actually determine whether the Big Bang was a single event or whether it may have been from the collision of two sort of extra-dimensional universes, the so-called brain theory, which is short for membrane. And you can actually observe the difference between these two. This is the first time I've ever heard of being able to discern between two competing theories for the origin of the universe. And we might have the technology to do this within 20 years, you know, with delays and everything. I'm sure it'll be 30. But it's possible. And so this, is, to me, is amazing. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'll just sit back and wait. I'll let smart people work out the math and the physics. And when the engineers get good enough to build these telescopes, hey, we may get an answer, a real answer.
What's your take on dark matter? What the heck do you think this is?
Oh, man. Dark matter is kind of fun. It's fun to talk about because a lot of people don't want to believe in it for whatever prior reasons. And I think the problem is they don't understand why astronomers came up with this. And the first thing that was noticed is that clusters of galaxies like the Milky Way, tend not to live by themselves. They tend to exist in clusters with sometimes thousands and even tens of thousands of other galaxies, like bees around a hive. And you can measure how quickly these galaxies are orbiting the center of the cluster. You can also measure, sort of, the mass of each galaxy by looking at how much light it emits. We kind of understand that, you know, brighter galaxies have more mass and dimmer galaxies have less mass. And when you add up all the mass in the galaxy, you realize that, all the mass of all the galaxies in the cluster, you realize that the cluster itself doesn't have enough mass such that its gravity can hold these galaxies together. At the speeds they're moving, this cluster should fly apart almost as before it can even form. So there must be more mass there holding this cluster together. But we don't see it. Therefore, it's dark. That's why it's called dark matter. Now, if that were the only observation of it, astronomers wouldn't be worried too much about it. But it turns out it crops up in other observations. Galaxies appear to be rotating too quickly all by themselves, which means they have more mass in them. And there are other observational aspects of it. And in fact, even though it's dark, let me step back a second. It's dark, we don't see it. We know it's there because of its gravity. Well, it turns out that gravity can act like a lens. When light passes by an object that has mass and gravity, the path bends for that light. And so you can measure this. And it turns out that when you look at clusters of galaxies, they have so much dark matter, you can map where the normal matter is. And then by looking at how the gravity of the cluster itself warps the light coming from more distant objects, you can actually map out where the dark matter is. And this was done for the first time this year. A map was released of dark matter around a cluster. Let me tell you, I was at the press conference where they released this data, and people's jaws were hitting the floor. This was astonishing. And this is actually in... this was last year. I'm getting my stories confused. Last year this was released. This year they actually made a three-dimensional map of it by exploiting some extremely complicated techniques, and they were actually able to map this thing in three dimensions. And that's where we were just totally floored by this. And so the question remains, what is this stuff? It's not planets. It's not dead stars. It's not gas, because we can observe that stuff. It is some sort of bizarre subatomic particle, we think, that does not interact with normal matter.
What's its purpose?
Well, you know, it's just out there.
Everything's got a purpose.
Don't you think?
Even a mosquito, Philip, has a purpose.
Yeah, well, it plays a part in galaxy formation and in cluster formation. Early on in the universe, there's a lot more dark matter than normal matter by like a factor of 10 or something like that. And so there's 10 times more of this stuff. And so it actually helped galaxies form in the first place. And it's been a big mystery. I mean, for decades, we haven't understood what this stuff is. Now there's a theory that it's a type of subatomic particle called a WIMP, which stands for a weakly interactive massive particle. It doesn't interact with normal matter well, so it's weakly interacting. But it's very massive. It has a lot more mass than normal protons and electrons and stuff. And it turns out that it's possible that these things interact with each other, and when they do, they give off a little tiny blast of light in the form of what's called gamma rays. Well, NASA is launching a satellite which can detect gamma rays far better than any previous satellite. It's going to launch in, I think, May of next year. It keeps getting delayed. There are some issues with it. But it'll get launched next year in 2008. It will be able to look for this particular type of gamma ray. And if it can detect it, that will be a confirmation that dark matter is actually this type of particle. And this will be huge if they do this. And even if they don't see it, that's going to be important as well, because that means that dark matter is not made of the stuff and we're back to square one. But either way, this is one of the biggest mysteries in astronomy right now, and there are a lot of smart people working on it. And it's really exciting to know that they're out there and thinking about it, and that we may understand this stuff very well in 5 years.
Well, in 5 years, that's a dramatic estimate.
It's possible. I mean, with GLAST, this satellite, the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope, this is one of the satellites I did educational work for at Sonoma State. It's totally possible that by observing certain stars and certain things, we'll be able to detect this stuff directly for the first time. And so it's completely possible that in a year we'll know more about this stuff. 5 years is just hedging my bet.
Where does this all lead to, Philip? All this information, all this data, the conclusion will tell us what about the universe? How it started? Why it's here? Will we ever get that far?
Yes. How do you like that answer?
I like right. that answer. Now elaborate on it.
People always ask me, why are we doing this? I say, because we're human. This is what we do. We explore and we learn, and sometimes learning stuff is not so fun. You know, we learn things that are bad. We learn that things are dangerous, or we hear bad news. But even then, I prefer bad news if it's going to help me. If we learn that Apophis is going to hit the Earth, that's bad. But that also means we have time to fix it, and that's good. So learning things is a survival trait. And so we need to learn more about this. And you might say, well, dark matter, who cares? You know what? I don't know what or if ever any sort of real everyday effect learning about dark matter will have. For all I know, it'll lead toward the invention of anti-gravity and gravity control and all that stuff. I don't know. You certainly can't promise that. But two things. One is that Carl Sagan brings up the example of James Clerk Maxwell, who was not funded and was just this guy who loved math, wrote down four equations, which he understood is how electricity and magnetism behaves. Those four equations are the foundation of radio, television, microwaves, radar, everything. We're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars in industry over the past century, because this guy was just fiddling with a little bit of math, which he thought had no real fundamental use, okay? So you never know where this stuff's going to lead. And that's the practical side of it. But there's also just the joy of finding this stuff out. When you the first time you solve a crossword puzzle all the way through, or you get a brain teaser and you figure it out, or you just look up in the sky and you stand there and you look at the stars, and there are thousands of stars in the sky, and you think, we understand them. I know why that star is blue and that star is red. We know the distance to that star. I know how old it is. Just understanding the universe is important, and it's what makes us human. It's what lets us use these big brains and figure stuff out. And I cannot think of anything more important than that, except supporting other people as being human beings as well. And I think all of this together is what the human condition is being excellent to each other, as Bill and Ted said in their movie, and also learning about reality and the universe around us.
I just wonder if all of this truly will help us find God, Philip.
Well, you know, if you're...
And I'm saying that in a broader sense. I mean,
sure, if you're predisposed for that sort of thing, you know, whether you're an atheist or whether you're any one of the religions in this world, I can't see where studying the universe is the wrong thing to do. No matter what, it will lead to good things and understanding things better. And if there is a God that created this universe, studying the universe can only lead to better answers about that. And if there's no God that created this universe and it was totally, you know, a random quantum fluctuation or something like that, that is another, well, I hate to say data point because that sounds so cold, but that is another step in our understanding, you know, where we are and what our place is and how the universe works. Either way, I find the stuff to be of fundamental importance. And the fact that it's just so much fun is just a benefit.
There's an ingredient here, Philip, that we really haven't concentrated on, and let's take just a few minutes to think about that, and that is why. What's it all about, Alfie, you know? the old saying, I mean, why is it all here? What are we doing with it?
You know, a lot of people, when I talk about religion and science, they say science tells us how and religion tells us why. And I think, well, that's a huge oversimplification, and it's I don't even think it's correct in the first place. But I think by understanding how, we kind of learn why. You know, to give an example, some things really irritate me or scare me. Some people have a phobia of spiders, for example, or snakes or whatever. And by learning... You might not know why they have that, but by learning how the brain works and how our minds go one way versus another because of a hormone that gets generated or, you know, some synapse trips instead of that one, by learning the hows of the brain and how it works, we learn the whys of psychology and say, oh, you know, if you damage this part of the brain, you know, you can induce this sort of psychological issue in somebody. The how leads to the why. And so right now we're at a stage in our lives where we've only had telescopes for 400 years. We've only had microscopes for somewhat less than that. We're only learning about how this stuff works. We still don't understand what role viruses play, for example, in evolution and why we are the way we are. We don't know why the universe exists. Why is there something rather than nothing? This is probably the most fundamental question that you can ask, either philosophically or scientifically. I think that by studying more, by learning more about dark matter, dark energy, by learning about how planets form, all of these things are pieces in a gigantic, gigantic puzzle that eventually we will fill in more and more of. And the puzzle may be infinite in extent. It may go on forever. But as the more puzzle pieces we put together, the better we will understand the how. And I think that will eventually lead to the why.
I think it may, too. And, Philip, by the way, you're just a great guest.
Thank you.
Thoroughly enjoy talking with you about these
things. Something about the way you lead the guests that makes me want to expand and expound and just have fun with this stuff.
Well, we're going to take phone calls next hour. You ready for that?
Yay.
Okay, you got it. Philip Plate is here, and so will you be. We'll open up the phone lines in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, if you need to email me while I'm away, it's george@coasttocoastam.com. I'll be taking a little vacation, one of my very rare ones. But we'll be back with Philip Plate and your calls next.